Species.
Unite.
Species. Unite.
We make everything from a vegan rib. So we got a rib that'll blow your mind. Looks like a rib, tastes like a rib, but guess what? It ain't a rib. So we make ribs that literally mimic, it can go on the grill. You can smoke it. You can literally barbecue it. And it comes out like mama's ribs you ate when you grew up.
Hi, I'm Elizabeth Novogratz. This is Species Unite. We have a favor to ask. If you like today's episode and you have a spare minute, could you please rate and review Species Unite on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to podcasts? It really helps people to find the show. This conversation is with Chef G.W. Chu. Chef Chu is the founder and CEO of Something Better Foods. He has spent the last 20 years as a plant-based restaurateur and a vegan food inventor. And he's created this line of incredibly delicious alternatives to comfort foods like fried chicken, ribs, fried fish. And he's done all of this with the goal of democratizing healthy plant-based foods by making them affordable and accessible to all people. How are you?
Good to meet you. I'm doing wonderful.
I'm so glad that you're here. Thank you so much.
Yeah, absolutely.
I want to talk about everything, but I want to start with your name.
Okay.
Because it's awesome.
Yeah, I love it. So my last name is actually Chu, which is pretty interesting. What's cool about my last name, I was adopted at birth. And so into a family that had the last name Chu. So that's kind of what makes it really cool. It was a Black African-American family. And so my last name is actually C-H-E-W. I like to say, as I always say, going to give you something to chew on. And I always say, born with the mission, born with the purpose, born to change lives one chew at a time. My first name is G.W. That's my real name. My mother always told me, says, you know, your name is G.W. So she says it's going to be easy to learn your name. It's only two letters. So you're never going to forget it. So it's pretty cool.
Talk a little bit about how you grew up around food, because it's as absolutely opposite as you can get to your life now.
Oh, yeah. My family lived in a small rural town in southern Maryland. Literally, you know, when we think about food, like my father, I was born in 1982. My father was still sharecropping. Okay. So that's a really hard thing to understand, like that sharecropping still existed at that time.
Could you explain how?
You know, many African-American families post-slavery, many of them became sharecroppers, where they actually would pretty much, in essence, lease the land and would pretty much split the profits, whatever that percentage would be, with the white landowner typically. And so that system was, you know, a lot of time was abused. You know, many people pretty much stayed in this a perpetual state of poverty because they pretty much never had land ownership. And so they pretty much for generations, families would do this without any ownership, but would do all the work and not build wealth for their communities. As a result of that, when you think about it from that perspective, most of them ate, you know, scraps, they ate from the land, they ate pretty much, you know, whatever they could to survive. Like my father's, the house that he grew up in, one of my cousins still lived there with his mother, his sister still lived there. And it was a one bedroom house that literally had an outhouse. And so, you know, again, very rural, you know, small community. People ate off the land, but food was still a great experience. Like, so, you know, we ate, you know, sadly, we ate a lot of animals. So, you know, fried chicken ribs, pork chops, ham, ribs, you know, you name it, we ate it. I was also in the right close to the bay. So seafood was a really big thing in our community. Crabs was a really, the blue crab. I lived in the Chesapeake Bay, so that was a really big thing. Seafood, a lot of meats, but then we ate stuff like squirrel, you know? So like, you know, my father would sit in the window and shoot squirrels while I grew up. You know, that was a normal Saturday morning event. Like just seeing him in the window, got the window poked down. He's literally shooting a squirrel in the window. And then 3 hours later, you see it literally hanging up in the garage. He skinned it and everything. He would tell me and tease me like, yeah, you didn't, we don't eat possum no more, but they ate possum, muskrat, you know, all those type of things was normal in their childhood because it was just survival. And so growing up, you know, food obviously was a big part of our culture. Beyond just the meat eating, you know, we had our soul food iconic dishes, mac and cheese, potato salad, sweet potato pie, and, you know, all these dishes were just mainstays in our family. And most of, you know, when we had our holidays, you know, you think about Thanksgiving, cookouts in the summertime. My father would have a big cookout every year. You know, these were where the family would showcase their best dishes. And so a lot of the great memories that I have as a kid and as a child was really around, you know, food, you know. And so food for me, you know, was more than just eating food. It was really a part of my culture, you know, which extended into becoming a part of my identity, if you want to say. So growing up eating that way, and then when I became, as I got older, transitioning to a plant-based lifestyle, a vegan lifestyle, I was almost as crazy. I would say one last piece of that story, though. My mother's side of the family were Seventh Adventist. And so Seventh Adventist community, it's a world religion, but many of them are vegetarians. And so
I never knew that.
I got exposed as a kid to vegetarian meats. And so a lot of it was like, you know, old school Morningstar before was popular, but they had stuff like in cans, like Loma Linda, you know, stuff in beef franks and cans and all kind of crazy stuff that you really know is not popular these days. So as I got older, I ended up making that personal decision to become Seventh Adventist, which led me to become 100% vegan in my experience, 100% plant-based. And so, yeah, it was a journey for me, but food was a very big part of my experience growing up.
What really kind of pushed you over the edge into veganism?
It was a few things. One of the primary things was one of the aspects. I did become a Seventh Adventist, so it was a very big spiritual decision. It was kind of natural within becoming a Seventh Adventist that you adopt a vegetarian lifestyle. But many people were not vegans. Veganism and, you know, going completely like no dairy. Most of them were vegetarians, so it was still a lot of dairy eating, you know, that kind of thing. This is like 2001, you know, so this is before vegan or plant-based foods was popular. But I also saw a lot of premature death in my family. You know, so again, growing up, how we ate, you know, many of my uncles and my aunts were obese, diabetes, heart disease, cancer, you know, and sometimes they would have this other issues that wasn't really, they were like the precursors of some of those chronic diseases. They would have hemorrhoids and, you know, gout and some of these other things that was not as, again, life threatening, but it was the precursors. But a lot of it was lifestyle related.
Were you connecting it to food, like, at the time?
When I became 18, that's when it all started clicking. It was like, I'm losing family members. Like, I'm talking about within 5 years, at least five or six aunts and uncles dies within this time frame. And all of them are not even 60 yet. Like, they're literally before the age of 60. So it's this, you know, so it all began to click. I started seeing this connection between how we ate and the connection of how it impacted our health. And that, again, a plant-based lifestyle would be obviously a solution to reverse or prevent. You know, Black Americans, you know, have twice the amount of rates of diabetes, you know, and if you kind of go down the list of statistics, is this pretty crazy when you look at it. So I started, as I kind of got more into it, I began to start really seeing this connection between social justice and access and, you know, all of that. Like, these communities actually didn't have access to these type of to healthier options. And so all of that kind of grew over the years. But I think the initial component of that was really just a desire to just save life. You know, if I can get people that grew up eating a piece of fried chicken, if I can get them my plant-based chicken that I make currently, if I can give them, you know, something that tastes delicious and look like what they used to eat, you know, I could actually help them to transition. So it was more of starting out was more of this, let me figure out how to make a piece of chicken that looks like chicken, tastes like chicken, but it's not chicken. If I can figure this out, I can get you to eat healthier. And that was kind of the excitement. So that led more to product development. Like, I literally went deep into, you know, recipe development and really got deep into the food, kind of being a chef and learning how to cook.
Were you a chef already?
No, when I was 18, 19, I went to business school. Again, I was crazy. So I was in B school at Howard University, leading HBCU. I quit college to work at an organic farm.
So, this is awesome. This is such a good story.
Yeah. Ended my first freshman year of college, 3.6. I'm in the honors business school. I come home and tell my mom, I'm quitting college and I'm going to go work in an organic farm. And so she's like, what the hell? Like, what's going on? The school was like, they gave me a free scholarship because I did so well my first year, gave me a free ride. And here I'm like, I'm about to go work at this organic farm and literally go pick vegetables. But I had this strong conviction and strong urge. I wanted to make my own way. And I kind of got into food like early. And that's kind of how my journey began. And immediately thereafter, a year later, I'm actually making my first product. I'm making granola. I'm making crunchy, bunchy granola. We don't box, but we got a granola that will knock you out. So I started making granola, healthy granola. And I was going door to door, selling books door to door. And cookbooks, healthy vegan cookbooks, door to door. I had granola and so forth. And that kind of began my first steps into the food industry.
And was there a spiritual component this whole time too?
Unpacking the spiritual component, it really was. I mean, this, you know, again, Seventh-day Adventist Christian, we do believe in the Bible. And we looked at Genesis, the Genesis story in scripture that talked about, you know, this from the very beginning, there was a diet of fruits and grains and vegetables. I mean, it was pretty much a plant-based diet from the onset. Our interpretation of scripture is that meat only came in out of necessity. Once, after the flood story, and then, you know, pretty much meat was more for that. But if you look in scripture, like it was a story in the Bible about a man named Daniel, who actually did one of the first plant-based experiments. He went, you know, plant-based for 10 days, and he told the king Nebuchadnezzar and said, listen, you know, look at my face and look at the other people, because they were taken captives, and they said, and the king gave them all the luxuries of the good food, and that was the meat and the wine. And Daniel told the king and said, hey, I don't want to eat this food. I want to eat a plant-based diet. And after those 10 days in the book of Daniel chapter 1, it says he came out healthier, you know, and he also was stronger. His face looked a lot better. And he literally is like the first scientific experiment on somebody eating plant-based compared to eating, you know, a meat-centered diet. It's kind of like it's in a scientific journal if you ever look it up. And so, you know, the plant-based, that whole concept of going plant-based is a biblical concept. People kind of argue that because, you know, they did do sacrifices and stuff like that. But when you look at the scripture in holistic, you know, our interpretation is that a plant-based lifestyle is the best from environmentally speaking, physically speaking, health. You know, when you look at all the health outcomes and what they've done, like in our church, there's a place called Blue Zones. I forget the other ones, but Loma Linda, California, to speak about specifically, it's a very high population of Seventh-day Adventists. We actually created what they call back in those days, like in the early 1900s, they had something called sanitariums, which are pretty much kind of lifestyle treatment centers that didn't really use medicine, but more like hydrotherapy treatments and lifestyle treatments. And long story short, Seventh-day Adventists kind of congregated there, and they created a hospital, created a college of medicine, et cetera. They did studies on the populations in those areas, and their life expectancy was like literally 10 to 15 years longer than the average American. And the crazy part about that was that many of those individuals were of a diverse ethnicity. So there wasn't this, you know, this one ethnic group. It was very diverse. And so what it showed was that, you know, plant-based lifestyle, going vegetarian, most of our members, you know, in that community, they don't drink alcohol, they don't smoke and things of that nature. And so the faith perspective very much, I mean, to be honest, was the inspiration behind the development with the mission of being able to really be able to provide a solution that can help people holistically. That was really the heart mission of it.
I want to know, so you're making granola, like I'm assuming at home, right, to begin with?
At home, that's where I started, absolutely.
And how do you go from that to inventing and creating plant-based proteins that have never existed before?
Oh, man. Well, you know, it started there. It was more or less, you know, granola was kind of like the curiosity of food. It was kind of like I found this passion. So when I started making granola, it was really for, we had a little missionary team. And again, we sold books. And I was making food for our missionary team. So I was, you know, I started making granola. So I had a little cookbook. When I'm making granola, rather than just taking a cookbook and making granola, I'm literally making up names. So rather than saying, you know, I got regular this granola, I got sensational strawberry granola. You know, I got pleasing pineapple granola. So I'm making up names, making up slogans. And this passion of food was really starting to be birthed. And eventually, you know, I ended up being able to go into commercial kitchens making granola on a larger scale. So I was able, the lady in the community that we met, we asked her, could we use a bakery? She taught us how to use like commercial equipment, big ovens. And all along this, I'm starting to experiment with vegetarian meats. So I'm literally starting to take oats and basic ingredients, nothing like super scientific that I'm doing now. It was like literally taking oats and potatoes and tofu and these different ingredients and just trying to make a veggie meat. So I took an oat burger and I turned a regular old school oat burger, which looked like cookies typically. I turned the oat burger into a little chicken leg. And when I did that, it was like my aha moment. It was like, I was just literally like, I fell on the floor. I was like, it was just the craziest thing I could ever think of. Like, how in the world could I turn an oat burger into a piece of chicken? Because normally it's like an oat patty or a burger. And so when I saw it as a chicken, my mom was like, I can make vegan chicken, you know? And it's like, it just started there. At that point, this is 2003, 2004. I literally started taking every grain, every bean I can get my hand on and started experimenting with different ratios, different combinations of different formulas. And over time, almost 3 or 4 years after doing like tons of different formulas, tons of recipes, I created my own proprietary texturization process.
What does that mean?
I learned how to take beans and create like through like 7-8 steps, get to a layered kind of texture that created like where literally the meat, it almost peels on itself. And so I learned some techniques that I've mastered, and now we're, you know, in the process that we sell today in the grocery stores. I learned this process over like a 5 or 6 year period. And I've been learning how to scale that process over the last 10 years and mastering that process. Even as of last, like a year and a half, you know, a year ago, we just perfected our breading process. Like, so it's been a 15 year in the making, like recipe development through 3 restaurants that I've had over the years that customers giving me feedback, iterating. So it's been a labor of like my life work has been perfecting this process, this protein. Like yesterday, we just got voted. One of the leading plant-based magazines voted us the best vegan fried chicken in the space right now. So it's pretty amazing.
Awesome.
Yeah. So
it's called Something Better Foods, and you make all different types of meat.
Yeah. So normally in our industry, the typical processes of plant-based meat manufacturing is done through a process called wet extrusion, which is a very high temperature kind of manufacturing process that creates like a vertical strain of protein. So most of the plant-based meats you taste in the market are kind of compacted, you know, it's kind of like a stringy kind of texture. And that comes from the similar process called extrusion. Our product creates layers of protein. So we're able to take that product and create a true fried chicken-like experience. We actually create a shredded steak. So you can literally make your own carne asada tacos. You can make your own any kind of Asian stir fry or Asian soup, like a pho or a ramen. It goes inside of that perfectly. We make everything from a vegan rib. So we got a rib that'll blow your mind. Looks like a rib, tastes like a rib, but guess what? It ain't a rib. So we make ribs that literally mimic. It can go on the grill. You can smoke it. You can literally barbecue it. And it comes out like mama's ribs you ate when you grew up. So, you know, we have various textures. We do, you know, everything from a fried chicken to a chicken nugget. We can kind of cut it in different shapes and sizes and do different things with it. And so we have a retinue of, you know, variety of products that we've been able to create with this process. And it's pretty amazing.
When you first started and started getting good and the food started getting good, were people in the community, were they just astonished?
It was funny because my family is my biggest critic. So my aunt, when I first started making my food products and stuff, they was like, it looks horrible, but it tastes good. Like it was just like this, it looked the greatest, right? So like my looks of my food wasn't great, but the taste of it was like, man, the taste is amazing, you know? And so as time went on, my mom and just my other family members, that's where it started, just getting them to test it, my cousins and everybody. And eventually I started my first vegan restaurant in my hometown. In this meat and potato rural town, I started the first vegan restaurant. And probably since 2008 has been the last one. I don't know if anybody else has done another one.
Did people come?
Yeah, they came. I won't say they came in groves, but they came. But I had a faithful customer base. It was very different. It was way before its time. And I got a lot of great feedback, but it became the very fundamental kind of stage of me commercializing what I was doing.
And a testing kitchen, too.
Exactly. It was the first. And I did 2 restaurants beyond that. And it just kept improving. So that first restaurant was, like you said, was the very beginning experience, getting meat eaters to go vegan, right? To go plant-based. I mean, the funniest thing was like when I had Thanksgiving with my family, my father's side of the family, and all the jokes that I would get. I mean, and the curiosity of wanting to try what I was doing. It was all of that combined, and really great experience. So I had a lot of fun with my family back then.
And then the next one, was that in Maryland also?
No, actually, that was in Arkansas. I was literally in Fayetteville, Arkansas, which is right beside the headquarters of Tyson. Springdale, Arkansas is Tyson's Food. So I'm literally in the headquarters of Chicken Capital of the Country. And also Walmart is right there. So I mean, this whole like meat centered, like, you know, so they just thought I was this. The great thing, I was in a college town. So I was in Fayetteville. So a little bit more progressive, but nonetheless, it was still meat potato town, you know, but I learned it did pretty well. You know, this is 2011, 2012 and had it for a few years out there. And then lastly, I went to Oakland, California, which, you know, seems more natural, right? Oakland.
A little more open.
Yeah, yeah, more open. And this was 2016 all the way to last year. I had that restaurant and that did phenomenal. I mean, it was just, you know, plant-based went crazy. Everybody's, you know, talking about veganism and, you know, and all of that. So it was just the timing couldn't have been better for that restaurant.
That's awesome. And so the one in Oakland, you closed down?
Yeah, I closed down only because I was starting a manufacturing company. And I had been doing restaurants for years, and I just kind of got to a place where I wanted to focus on getting our manufacturing established. It's been an amazing journey. Now we're looking to open up another restaurant again. So, hey, kind of full circle back again.
I know when you had Veg Hub in the restaurant in Oakland, a lot of your work, and a lot of your work, I'm assuming, still is on fighting food deserts. So for people who don't really understand, will you first talk about what food deserts are?
Food deserts, I mean, it's ironically, is not a desert as in a sense of food does exist in the food desert. It's just typically the food choices and the food, you know, food that exists is just foods that are just horrible, honestly, for your health. You look at these places. I mean, if you ever take a ride to any kind of inner city and even sometimes very rural communities, but I'm speaking specifically, let's say now on an inner city kind of highway, you know, in a place that of poverty, typically you'll see a bunch of liquor stores. You see a whole bunch of kind of cash and carry stores, you know, people just pay their loans. And then we go more into the food, you know, it's just, you got chicken shack here, fish fry shack here. You know, you got these little small convenience stores, which has a bunch of snacks and, you know, so the food choices are there. This fast food, junk foods, this horrible quality foods. And then the environment, again, is just it's built in poverty. The a lot of times the people are afraid to be, you know, people being burglarized. So most of the places are kind of caged up. So, you know, you think about it, you're getting your food in places that are like caged up, and it's not going to be typically any grocery stores. And so, you know, so you talk about a place that has food options, but very poor food options. And the question that you ask yourself is why? How did that happen? How do you have a place that doesn't have access to healthy food options?
Or even a grocery store, right?
Not even a grocery store. I mean, and when you really start peeling the onion on this, I mean, so many reasons, but you really got to start. It becomes a really social justice issue. You start looking at structural racism. And so literally structurally, you know, post-World War II, many places in urban communities were redlined. And so, and as a result of redlining, what that simply did, it pretty much, you know, the communities were redlined, literally redlined on the map. And they said, hey, these minorities, which is mostly at that time, Black Americans, would live in this part of the community. And the suburbs, which were being built at that time, you know, typically were white Americans that got great loans. And so those communities became the thriving places of where grocery stores centered themselves. So grocery stores centered themselves around suburban America. But in some of these, you know, we call them hoods, you know, these type of places, you know, it wasn't advantageous for grocery stores to go in those communities because it was high risk. It was a lot of crime. Insurance companies would give them higher rates. There wasn't any incentive for businesses to actually be created in those communities, which in turn, you know, you're not going to get the grocery stores. You're not going to get, you know, people wanting to start, you know, great businesses in those communities. And technically speaking, a food desert is a place where within, you know, within a 1 mile to 5 mile radius, there's no food options, pretty much healthy food options. And then you have programs like, you know, government subsidy programs like WIC, you know, in some of those places. And, you know, and a lot of those things with this, you know, that people call about government cheese and all of that type of stuff. And so very poor quality food, poor quality, you know, even if you did eat meat, poor quality meats. And so that was the foods that were being given for free to nourish these communities. And so these communities, high stress, alcohol is, you know, readily available and drugs readily available. So you talk about crack cocaine, right, is put into these communities, which is, you know, a normal fact in the 80s, you know, that happened. So, you know, so here you have a community that's is stressed out, drugged up, and not good food options. And you can only can imagine the results. And then you have a prison pipeline system that pretty much, you know, takes all of that energy where there's no jobs, no opportunity. And, you know, you have a whole pipeline of young men and young women, you know, literally, you know, not finishing school. School systems doesn't have any incentive. And so there's no education opportunities typically. And so you just, you know, that's that's the storyline for many urban places across the country. And as a result of that, here we are with the diseases that we see in some of these communities. So it's a really, really big issue, and it's not easy to change, you know, when you look at it.
I think a lot of people who'd never even heard the term food desert finally like started to wake up during COVID when the death rates were so much higher in Black and Brown communities because of food, right? And because of diet. And so at least it started getting talked about, but you don't really hear many people talking about solutions.
I mean, you know, one of the things we need, you know, one of the things I'm really big on about solutions is that, you know, number one, there are access points already in these communities. So whether it's a church that you can sell through and get these type of products into the stores, I mean, you commend some of these major food techs, you know, that's getting products in the KFCs and stuff like that, that's kind of veganizing some of these menus or providing healthier options. That's a big option as well. And bigger companies can support that and do that. But I think it's really a grassroots work. One of the things I really will say is that ownership, creating ownership in these communities, typically people from those communities want to do better for themselves, but they don't have access or opportunity. And so we really, it's really a, I think it's a big, it's an economic change because there's people there that want to solve their problems. You know, it's not like, you know, it's not like people are just like, oh, I just want to be here forever. Like, but they don't have access and investment and so forth. And so one of the things that we speak really big on is creating, you know, our company, for example, Something Better Foods, we are a manufacturing company. The liquor stores that are there, the convenience stores that are there, they don't own any of them. You know, that's, you know, it doesn't look like me that's owning those stores. So all that whole block is not even owned by the people that actually live in that community. So one of the things what I promote is that, you know, how do you solve it? We need to create ownership for people that live within these communities. You know, co-ops are obviously great examples of ways that communities can come together and kind of take control of their food. You know, and there are examples of that, people doing that within these communities. But I believe, you know, one of the greatest things is, you know, restaurateurs going into these communities. That's a really easy touch point because, you know, you're getting grandmama who ate this way all of her life to transition to eating a plant-based lifestyle. You have to have a touch point that's doable for them to change. So restaurants have been phenomenal. It's been tons of vegan restaurants in Black communities across the country that have been.
And it's happening more and more, right?
Absolutely.
It's growing.
Absolutely. And so that's a very easy touch point. Having a vegan restaurant that becomes a place people can get good food, healthy food. And that's a great place of exposure for many places across the country. But I want to dig a little bit further in distribution and manufacturing. I think that's where you're going to make your biggest changes. It's again, us having ownership, you know, even in rural America, us having farms that we own and we kind of control some of the supply chain. So it's a really big picture when you start talking about systems change and really start talking about really kind of solving this. It's a 100-year plan. But I believe that you really got to start dealing with who owns and controls the means of production for these communities and empowering people from those communities to be able to control some of that, which allows them to feed their community and be able to provide for their communities a lot better than what's being done currently.
Right. Right. Well, you're working on it. I mean, and that's what VegHub's purpose was as well.
That was it. That was really the model. And the reason why we went into manufacturing was that, well, you know, our goal is to scale a restaurant model, so they have multiple restaurants. And so when you control your manufacturing, your cost of production is so much cheaper. And so I can provide that product, you know, rather than me buying that burger from a plant-based company, I make the burger, I make the product. So now I can sell it to my restaurant so much cheaper, which I can be able to give that price savings to that individual, to that customer. When you have manufacturing, you don't have to sell through the grocery store. So you can sell right to the people. And so again, as there's a distribution aspect where food is marked up so much by the time it gets to the consumer. So if you have, you can manufacture and sell direct to people, that actually helps the price to be cheaper because again, people are on very low budgets in these communities. So it's a really holistic picture when you think about a long-term solution for these places and so forth.
And with Something Better, are you also just available like straight up to the people?
Yeah. So, you know, right now we just launched our direct to consumer. So eatbetterchew.com. So that's one of the ways that people can get our product. But what we are actively and working on is an actual brick and mortar model for the community. So we're actually looking at a place within Oakland right now. Bringing our Better Chew, it's going to be called Better Chew Vegan Community Kitchen. We're looking at actually launching that in the next 3 to 4 months. And that's going to be for the purpose of providing this very solution. So now, rather than me selling to the distributor that then sells to the grocery store, that then sells to you as a customer, you can come straight to the restaurant and I'm selling to you the same price that I sell to the distributor. If some people might say it might cannibalize, you know, my sales in the grocery store, but I think people are still going to go to the grocery store and still buy those products. But what it is doing is it's helping that person in that community that typically won't have access to a product like that, because a lot of times those stores aren't in those communities. And so we want to be that, create that model, you know, where we're literally bringing the product right to the community and selling it at like literally 30-40% less than what they would find in a typical grocery store. So that's kind of what we're working on, a phenomenal model that we hope to be an inspiration to the industry of how we can help solve some of these problems. I mean, the problem is too big for one person to do, but I at least can inspire, inspire people to change, you know?
And I mean, how incredible direction you've gone from restaurant, manufacturing. Okay, now we can manufacture and have restaurants and get in the communities, but also get in the stores. Like it's pretty genius.
Yeah, hey, it's a labor of love. And it's something that again, that's why I've been doing it for almost 20 years now, because it's not something that you just kind of can just replicate. It's something that you really have to have an intuition with people. It's very people-centered, that makes sense. Yeah. Yeah.
Is it creating community, like having had Veg Hub, and are people getting excited about eating that way?
Oh, absolutely.
Not more before?
I mean, COVID obviously was another, you know, ripping off the Band-Aid, like, you know, we're sick and this is what happens. You know, we die a lot faster. So people are obviously very aware of, like, we need to eat better because this is the reality. We have the highest rates of disease, highest rate of COVID-19 mortality. And so I just think that the world is just very aware of why. And I think there's people that are just looking for great solutions that can help provide that for them.
Well, and you have some. So I love that you've just been in it since birth, basically. Like, that name was given to you for a reason.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
Well, Chef Chew, thank you.
I appreciate you and what the work that you guys are doing, and I'm so happy that we can share our story and what we're doing.
To learn more about Chef Chew, go to our website, speciesunite.com. We will have links to everything. We are on Facebook and Instagram at Species Unite. And if you have a spare minute and could do us a favor, please subscribe, rate, review Species Unite on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to podcasts. It really helps people find the show. If you'd like to support Species Unite, we would greatly appreciate it. Go to our website, speciesunite.com, and click donate. I'd like to thank everyone at Species Unite, including Gary Knutson, Caitlin Pierce, Amy Jones, Paul Healy, Santina Polke, Bethany Jones, and Anna Kallner, who wrote and performed today's music. Thank you for listening. Have a wonderful day.